So the U.S. government actually rebuilt German, so-called German culture?
Absolutely. It probably had a lot to do with the return of Bayreuth, too. There was a very good question about what was going to happen with Bayreuth. And they finally agreed to – and I think the U.S. occupation must have had something to do with that as well. They took it away from Winifred Wagner, who was the widow of Siegfried Wagner's son, and gave it to her – the two grandchildren, the two male grandchildren. The women didn't get to do anything, though one of them – wasn't involved anyway, and Friedland, the fourth grandchild, ended up as an American citizen. She went to London, and then she went to New York, and I knew her from New York. But the two sons were Wolfgang and his brother. What was the brother's name? Famous stage director.
Not Willem. No.
No. I'm blanking out on the brother's name. Anyway. Wolfgang is the one that's still alive. The brother died, but he was the great stage director. His name will come to me in a moment. But they did a lot. USIS, there was a lot of money that went to cultural affairs. And later on, there was in the 60s, during the political upheavals, a lot of people were very suspicious about that. But I don't know. It's funny. I have mixed feelings about it now. For example, money went to support magazines and publications and cultural events and all sorts of things, because the whole business about supporting culture was considered part of the Cold War. And in fact, the fact that the Russians, for example, the Soviets, opposed a lot of avant-garde art was taken as a good reason for us to support avant-garde art. So the United States was supporting avant-garde art because it showed we were a free country, and they used it against the Russians who opposed it.
Well, at the beginning, they supported the futurists. And then squelched them.
Squelched the futurists, and absolutely, and in music too, there was something of a futurist movement in Russia, mm-hmm. and of course, a lot of composers, modernist composers, were attacked, including Shostakovich and
Prokofiev
were attacked very, very strongly, and it led to some very strange things. For example. Luigi Nono, who was a communist, was writing extremely avant-garde music with a social message to it, and would go to Russia. But if a Russian tried to write music like he did, they were in big trouble. They were in hot water. And he sometimes even had to come to the defense of some of his Russian colleagues because he had a certain amount of cachet. And famous story about Nono was when his Intoleranza was done by Sarah Caldwell in Boston, and he applied for a visa to come to the United States. And he went to the American consul's office in Venice, and it had a spot which said, "Are you now? Have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?" So he wrote, "Yes." And the consul looks at him and said, no, you don't want to say yes. No.
But he ran for mayor.
That's exactly what he said.
Really?
He said, "I ran for mayor on the Communist Party ticket. How can I say no?" Everybody knows I'm a communist. Anyway, it was eventually editorialized in the New York Times. I think he did eventually get the visa. It was during the Kennedy period, and somebody intervened.
But Italian communism is its own form of communism.
That's
kind
true.
Of very casual.
That's absolutely effect. True.
But getting back to Wagner, the drama in the family is still playing out. Trying which faction will
after
dominate.
All these years, it's playing out. It's gone into the next generation. It's totally amazing.
So, what's your prediction? Because we have a lot of folks who listen to this show and love Magne's presentation of the Ring. Remember Ring Day?
Well, Mortier was involved in that.
Yes, who's now in
Mortier,
New York?
Mortier, as his name should be pronounced. Yeah. But he went in with Nicke Wagner, who was one of the great grandchildren, but did not succeed. I think the final decision went to the other team, which was more closely allied with Wolfgang. So I don't know. I've kind of lost track of it. I used to know all the ins and outs of the Wagner family, but I've, as I say, I've lost a little bit of track of what was going on.
Do you see contemporary opera as influencing productions of the standard repertoire? In terms of stagecraft and...
You know, I don't. Most of the insofar as new ideas of stagecraft are coming into opera, and they are, I think they're coming in through other places. I think they're coming in through the influence of the what you refer to as the auteur director. Yes, I think there are influences, and I think that. The stage director has become a tremendously important figure in new opera. Obvious examples are people like Sellers and Bob Wilson and so on, some Europeans. I think there's a tremendous push in traditional opera, especially in Europe, to revitalize the traditional operas through modern stagecraft. Sometimes, with questionable results, sometimes with very exciting results. But because of the nature of the opera field, I'm not sure that much of it comes from contemporary opera per se. And I still remain convinced that the breeding grounds for new ideas in opera will be music theater. That is to say, small-scale music theater or small-scale opera, which takes place outside the precincts of the grand opera. So it is not burdened with the tremendous expense, with the expectations, with the competition, with the repertoire, all the things that with the routine of a repertory opera house. Although many modern opera houses are not really repertory anymore, but in theory they still are. With the whole issue about how you cast, how you rehearse new work, that's a very tough issue. Nobody in theater or film or any contemporary art works in that fashion anymore. So the opera houses are saddled with this tradition, more than tradition. They're saddled with the expense of operating these big houses, but also with the routines of how they work and with the routines of how things are cast. And so, you have a very funny situation because, for example, you have the so-called all-powerful stage directors, but they very often don't choose the casts. So they have this influence on stage, doing these extraordinary staging things, which are very break with tremendously with tradition, but they don't necessarily choose the performers of which have probably been signed up to contracts by the casting department of the opera house 5 years earlier. And that's very strange, because do you think a film director would walk in to direct a film without the right to choose his own cast? Or even a theater director doing a new piece in the theater would do that? No, they never would. But if you go into the opera house, that's what you're faced with. And also then the whole question of how you rehearse with orchestra, how you do replacements, for subsequent, sure. All that sort of thing. That's very hard in the opera house. The routines, the expense, the methodology, that's really tough.
Yeah, and some of the newer opera houses really have built alternative spaces, black boxes or whatever for small chamber performances. But yet when financial axe falls, that's the first thing to go.
Right. That's true. That's true. And I think in hard economic times, one of the greatest periods for new music theater was the 30s, or the 20s and the 30s. But particularly, I'm thinking about the 30s, when we were in a big depression, and yet music theater was at its liveliest, and including opera, but often not performed in opera houses. And now it'd be interesting to try to figure out why that's true, but it was true, and that extended well into the 40s, actually, when Menotti was operating and other people. So the question in my mind is whether those circumstances can reproduce themselves, because I think they have to.
Do you see digital or video recording of chamber works as a lifesaver and also a way of disseminating the works? Like Menotti, you mentioned Menotti.
Right.
First television operas. Help build his prestige and spread contemporary
they did,
work.
Yeah, they did. It's true. Yeah, I think that it plays a role, but I'm not sure that it replaces live performance. I think it amplifies live performance. I think live performance still has some very special role to play. I don't want to say religious role because it'll be misunderstood, but the whole idea of people coming together in terms of live performance,
sharing the experience,
is very important to the success of that art form. And then recording both audio and video amplify that or help extend that. But I'm not sure that. There's a lot of talk about art and technology and about new digital art. I'm not sure how much that's going to affect theater, our notion about theater. Film might. Film has more potential, partly because film takes place in an almost theatrical context. That is to say, it becomes a shared experience in a large theater. When you reduce it to the living room and the television screen, I'm not sure it has the same meaning.
Well, with surround sound 5.1, 5.2, who knows? We have the future to explore.
Well,
as it comes.
Yes and no. Again, I think theater has that special role to play in, and I think music theater is actually the oldest and most widespread of all the art forms. It predates spoken theater by a long time, and has always played a role in the evolution of both music and theater. When they come together, things happen.
That's Eric Salzman, co-author of The New Music Theater by Oxford University Press. You're listening to Through the Opera Glass here on WBAI 99.5. I'm Mark Leosa. Having a far-ranging discussion about the book and the upcoming event on December 10th at the Center for Contemporary Opera.
Yeah, it's actually at the Cell.
At the Cell.
It is sponsored by the Center for Contemporary Opera, and also the Cell itself is sponsoring it. The Cell is a new performance space, really a delightful space, at 338 West 23rd Street. And the colloquium is on December 10th at 8 p.m. It's open to the public, and there will be a discussion by Tomas and myself, the authors of the book, and also a panel which will consist of minimally Rindy Eckert, Steve Osgood, Diane Wandesford of Music Theater Group, and Greta Holby, the stage director. And we'll be doing that. We'll be discussing the book and the field in general. And as I say, the public is welcome.
If you've missed any part of this show, you can visit our website, www.wbai.org. Click on the archive and catch up. Eric, you have some music for us?
Well, I was thinking about recently I did a music for an interesting project. This is a French translation of a Brecht play. The play is known in English sometimes as The Good Woman of Sichuan or The Good Person of Sichuan. In French, it's called La Bonne Âme de Sichuan, which would be the good soul of Sichuan. It's a kind of an imaginary legend that Brecht came up with about the gods coming down to earth to look for a good person. And the only person who pays any attention to the gods at all, of course, is the prostitute with a heart of gold, naturally, greatly beloved by Brecht and his collaborators. And she puts them up, and they give her a little money to start a shop. And the shop is she has a lot of problems because all the relatives come and all the poor people, and they steal the merchandise, and she's in awful trouble because she's such a good person. She can't really control the situation. So she adopts a costume and the manner of her cousin. Her male cousin. She turns herself into the male cousin, who is as ruthless and as tough a capitalist as the good woman of Sichuan is a good person. And she goes into the opium business and has a big success with that. And the result is a wonderful text by Brecht. This is actually a version of the play that he did when he was in California. So it's known as the Santa Monica version. And he was hoping to get Kurt Weill, who was having a big success on Broadway at that time, to write the music. But Weill was finished with Brecht at that point, wouldn't have anything to do with it. At any rate, so ended up in a French translation, and I ended up doing the music. And anyhow, this is the Opium Song. And with a little, some of the other incidental music from the play, the prelude, the opium song. She eventually goes to the gods. She's accused of murdering her in her male guise. She's accused of murdering the good woman of Sichuan. So because she's disappeared. So the gods have a trial. And she goes and reveals that they're the one and the same person. And the gods say, okay, great. We finished our job here on Earth. And we have going back up to heaven. And she says, no, help me, help me. What do I do now? What do I do now? And the gods say, that doesn't concern us. And they disappear up in heaven and leave her to fend for herself. So this is the prelude, the opium song, the trial scene, a very brief introduction to the trial scene, and then the gods, the song at the end when they go back to heaven.
This is your first work in a foreign language?
Actually, not. I've set French several times. I've worked at one of the national theaters in France, and I've also worked in Quebec. This comes from the Trident, the Trident Theater in Quebec.
With English and German being one of the hardest to set, and Italian the easiest, where does French fall in between?
Well, French is... I like setting French, because French is... very different from English, German, even Spanish and Italian. And the reason it's so different is that all those other languages, including English, are all based on the tonic accent. So they're all finally based on da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But French is not. French is based on quantities, the lengths of the sounds, and doesn't have a strong tonic accent to it. And because of that, you can cross-accent French in a way that you cannot cross-accent English or German or Italian or Spanish. And that cross-accenting gives, to me, a very interesting flavor to what I would call a rhythmic counterpoint of the music when you're setting French words.
This might be a new concept. Would I be putting you on the spot to ask for an example of this cross-accenting?
Well, the easiest way to explain it is if you want to speak French in a way that's comprehensible to native French speakers, you have to forget your accent habits. There are other problems with French, but the most difficult thing for us is this accent business. And the problem is that even the French don't explain it very well. The example I love to give is a little phrase, which is the Principality of Monaco. And what you have to say is, le Principauté de Monaco. Le Principauté de Monaco. Now, either that's all the same accent, or either everything is accented or nothing is accented. I don't know which. But in Debussy, in Pelléas and Mélisande, you'll find the setting of Mélisande, which is impossible in English to translate the accent. If you change the accents on English words like that, you end up with incomprehensible mush. But in French, the issues are very different. They're all very different. There are other, it's not just accent, there's more than that. There's a question of whether you drop syllables or not drop syllables when you do sung French. There's other issues as well. Some of them are not intuitively obvious at all. But the result is you can actually put accents wrong, quote unquote, in French and get a counterpoint going, and it actually works. which it never would in English. So that's so I do like setting French. And they, you might hear a little bit of that in this setting.
Okay, and the title of the work in French, please?
Okay, La Bonne Âme de Sichuan, The Good Person of Sichuan. The text is by Bertolt Brecht, translated into French, and, well, the music's by me.
Autant de l'amour et de la bonté qu'on dit aujourd'hui bien dépassé. J'adorais la vie, je voulais m'en aveugler, je cherchais le paradis, une vie de pureté. Bien vite, j'ai eu ma leçon. L'illumination, je l'ai connue, je l'ai aimée. De toutes petites miettes qui rendent si heureux, malgré un destin toujours malheureux, il ne faudrait jamais cueillir le coquelicot sous prétexte qu'il sera.
Autrefois, je croyais que mon intelligence me sauverait, j'étais optimiste. Aujourd'hui, je suis vieux et je vois que j'avais tort. Vraiment, l'intelligence peut-elle combattre la famine? Donc je dis, allons. Aspirons la fumée noire, crachons-la vers les cieux gelés. Bientôt nous aussi nous disparaîtrons.
On dit que les vieux n'aiment pas l'espoir.
passer du temps et le temps file.
Tandis que pour les jeunes, les portes sont grandes ouvertes.
On dit les portes sont ouvertes, elles sont ouvertes sur le vide. Disons allons, aspirons la fumée noire, crachons-la vers les yeux gelés. Bientôt nous aussi nous disparaîtrons. Nous disons allons, aspirons la fumée noire, crachons-la vers les yeux gelés. Bientôt nous aussi nous disparaîtrons.
So that's music from La Bonne Âme de Sichuan, The Good Woman or The Good Person of Sichuan. That's a play of Bertolt Brecht, the Santa Monica version in a French translation. The production was directed by a wonderful director, Antoine Laprise, with the Théâtre du Trident, the Trident Theater of Quebec City.
And she ascends up into the heavens.
Well, the gods ascend into the heavens and telling her that everything is all right. And she's that voice you hear at one moment, like a big dissonance.
Right.
She's shouting, "Oh, Sekula, help me, help me." But they're not interested in helping her at all. They're just going up to heaven because they found the good woman. That's all they need.
Good woman's hard to find.
Yeah, right.
You're listening to WBAI. I'm Mark Leosa. We have Eric Salzman in studio, composer, writer, and one of the panelists at the Center for Contemporary Opera that will have an event at the Cell.
Yeah, it's being called a colloquium or forum, whatever you like. It's a discussion of the new music theater, the whole idea of discussing this new art form, a new old art form, I should say. But it will be based on the book. I will be there, and my co-author, Thomas Stacey, will also be there. The other panelists are Rindy Eckert, Steve Osgood, the conductor, Diane Wandesford, the director of Music Theater Group, Greta Holby, stage director also, and the head of Ardia Arts and founder of the American Opera Projects, and maybe Meredith Monk. We're hoping she's going to be able to come along. And the event is free. It's open to the public. It's at the Cell Theater on December 10th at 8 p.m., and that's at 338 West 23rd Street. And, hope to see you there.
Your work, this past work, reminds me very much of the kind of music Chris Wendt presents on Here of a Sunday Morning. That's coming up at 9 o'clock, so you folks tuning in a little earlier are getting a taste of contemporary music that resonates with historic forms, even the structure of the work. Did you do that intentionally?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, what's intentional and what's... I try always to work in the moment. Because of my interest in using theater and reviving the old connection between theater and music, which in one way you could call opera, but it's a very wide field and goes way back. Music theater to me is the oldest and the most widespread and also the newest of the art forms. So that's what makes it exciting, and that's what makes it relevant, I think, for our times.
We were talking earlier in the show about the nude paper sermon. Can we hear some music from it?
Sure. In fact, it's sort of appropriate because this is sort of my WBAI piece. I call it Tropes for Actor, Renaissance Consort, Chorus, and Electronics. And this is the opening of the second part of the piece, Side 2, as it was originally on the LP, or Act 2, if you prefer, in the theater version. It opens with a monologue called The Train, with the actor reading the monologue. This is Stacey Keach, and the performers doing semi-improvisation, conducted improvisations in the background. And then comes a series of interventions, which I call graffiti or whatever you want to call it. Anyway, you'll hear, which evokes the past. The piece is constantly about the past and the present, and they're always put into juxtaposition. And although in some ways it sounds very different from my more recent pieces, in a lot of ways there are a lot of elements in common. Anyway, let's hear Side 2 of
Nude Paper Sermon.
This is going to be the Nude Paper Sermon. It's performed by Stacey Keach, the Nonesuch Consort, members of the New York Motet Singers, conducted by Joshua Rifkin on a Nonesuch recording.
And who's the librettist?
Yes, that's a good question. The librettist for this, the main librettist, was a young writer named Stephen Wade, or Wade Stevenson actually was his real name, but he used that nom de plume. Then there are also fragments of texts by John Ashbery as well.
Okay, Nude Paper Sermon.
Train stands quiet and still has a workhouse, its flanks gently heaving upon the rails of the large solid station. We are moving more and more toward our Nokia economy. My cause, I think, has been called an era of post-civilization. In this era of post-civilization, it is probably not certain that the values of literature and art and culture and humanity for which we have talked for so long will gradually disappear. What will we be left with? A tabula rasa, a new exploded world. Well, man has always been able to adapt himself to change, shift his emphasis to new in perspective. In this sense, we should be proud, because we'll be at last getting rid of naked, 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 naked. We're being stripped, if not stripped already, of every support we have. No. Yes. No. Yes. No. Yes. No. Yes. No. Yes. No. Yes. No. No. Yes. Yes. No. No. Yes. No. Yes. No. Yes. No. Yes. No. Yes. No. Yes. No. 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 Yes. No. No. Yes. Yes. No. Yes. No. No. Yes. No. Okay. Slightly acid pear, strawberry, little thumb of your sex, fruit of the seas, oyster to be sucked, rose of the black mass, echo, fig, half undressed, two. Mythology, a glitter with phosphorus thalassa, where we make pilgrimages like Xenophon. Warm abyss. Velvet gloves turned inside out. Lively pulp. Salmon. Anemone. Pink shell. Brown algae. Tufted jewel, necklace, clock, candelabra, amulet, symbol, ornament, convoluted starfish, amulet, tufted, hive, darkness, yawns, inside, savor. Tunnel, hollow, mythology, a glitter, phosphorus, thalassa, sink yourself, medallion, clock, necklace, jewel, candelabra, rose cracker that I munch. Did you know that in America alone there are 15 million munchers?
Just a sample of the Nude Paper Sermon. What were we listening to, Eric Salzman, composer?
That was the beginning of part two, the train monologue, followed by the choral section called Ruins or Fragments or Graffiti, and the very beginning then of one of the madrigals on a text of John Ashbery. The actor's texts, which were written for the piece, are by Stephen Wade, and the actor was Stacy Keach. Nonesuch Consort, and the singers from the New York Motet Singers, and the ensemble conducted by Joshua Rifkin. And that was a Nonesuch commission, Nonesuch Records commission, and it was from a Nonesuch album dating back to the end of the 60s, actually. So gives you an idea of what I was doing back then. And this was one of the pieces, the early big-scale theatrical pieces that I did, which led to the development of the Music Theater Ensemble and my work and interest in music theater as a contemporary art form.
I'm drawing a blank. The
new music theater.
I'm thinking American for some
reason. Yeah, the new music theater, hearing the body, seeing the voice.
Okay.
And, and it's with Thomas Dacey. And we're having also a colloquium on the subject on December 10th, the evening of December 10th at 8 p.m. And that's sponsored by the Center for Contemporary Opera. And it's at The Cell, which is a new performance space at 338 West 23rd Street. You can also find out more about both the book and the other stuff on my website, which is ericsalzman.com.
And it's free, my favorite price.
Yep.
Not the book, but the colloquium.
Correct.
Okay, Helix. Eric Saltzman, an excerpt from his Helix. What year was that from, Eric?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. Well, it was while I was still at BAI, so it would have to be the early 70s. And it was recorded in the BAI studio. And that was Quag Music Theater in its early incarnation around 71, I would say, and maybe 72. And, the lead vocalist is Bill Zukoff, the countertenor, who is also, you also heard on the Western Wind piece, the jukebox in the Tavern of Love. And, so it's kind of nice to come back to BAI and celebrate after all these years.
Well, thank you for coming in and talking about the New Music Theater, your co-authorship with Thomas Desi.
Right.
Thomas Desi, yeah. Seeing the Voice, Hearing the Body. And December 10th?
Yeah, December 10th is our colloquium being sponsored by the Center for Contemporary Opera and the Cell. It's at 8 o'clock in the evening at this wonderful new performance space in Chelsea, 338 West 23rd Street. It's free and open to the public. We have a terrific panel, including Thomas and myself, and some performers, composers, conductors, and people involved in the field. And the public is welcome, so you're all welcome to come. And also, my website is ericsalzman.com. You can get more information there. The center's website is conopera.org. So you can also get information there about this event and other things that the center does. I'm involved with the Center for Contemporary Opera, which produces a lot of new work, both in the opera and music theater field, and we'll be doing so. Their season is well underway, and so you can keep track of that and come to some of those events. And, it was a pleasure being here.
Thank you, Eric. And if you've missed any part of the interview, please visit the website, www.wbai.org. I'm Mark Leosa thanking you. And if you have any questions, opinions, ideas, please send them to Through the Opera Glass. One word, throughtheoperaglass@hotmail.com. I'm Mark Leosa thanking you so much. Stay tuned for Chris Wendt and Hear of a Sunday Morning. Be well.